So our second speaker is Ronald Myers. He's going to be talking about a review of the physical basis of fine-tuning. So let's welcome him.
Okay, the anthropic principle is the idea that the universe appears to be designed for life, and it has been observed that small changes in the physical parameters and initial conditions will lead to a universe without life, which is called then fine-tuning. And this is led to this, the use of this fact as an apologetic. Now, to be sure, not without some controversy. However, since about 2008, some journal articles have been published in refereed journals showing how other parameter choices outside the previously considered narrow range will give rise to stars and elements that support life as we know it. This talk will review those and, well, the anthropic principle in general. And it should be noted that any apologetic is only as good as the science behind it, which is why I want to examine that here. And I'm going to leave the theology of improbability discussions for others. That's very definitely not one that I want to tackle, particularly in 20 minutes. Okay, these are the basic elements of the anthropic principle in the fine-tuning assertion. You have basically the universe-wide things, which are clearly unavoidable, and then you have the local items, which really all can be summarized as provisioning of the Earth with the elements we need, with the sunlight that we need, and the minimal hazards. And since there's an estimated 10 to the 22 stars in the universe, if not here, one could assert somewhere else, and possibly multiple somewhere else's. So leave that aside and look at the universe-wide ones, and the basic equation I'm not going to address either. That would be a heroic task. Look at the basic physical constants, the dimensionality, initial conditions, and whether there are stars or not in the universe. And the accessible parameters, really the ones that the Big Bang Theory was developed with in the first place, which is, again, dimensionality, initial condition, which is the baryon photon ratio, the four force constants, and two mass ratios of the more common, more common particles. And then there are the anthropic principles, or assumptions, which go into this as well. You need stars or something like it to power us. Since we're reduced entropy beings, we need a power source. And then you'd also need stability. It doesn't really matter how life is made, particularly, but once it's made, you need a stable universe to allow it to continue. And then the biophilic elements, and those are listed, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus, and a few other little smattering of some of the heavier ones. This, unabashedly, is life as we know it. And then life is complex, both topologically and just there's a lot of things that go into what a cell is made out of. These are defensible, but again, this is going to be beyond the scope of this talk. And so you can look at the literature on the anthropic principle and fine-tuning, and you can divide it nicely between what was done and what's now being done more recently. From the mid-50s to about now, you have a lot of articles supporting fine-tuning as we normally can conceive of it. Premier reference is Burrow and Tipler. Now, this is from 86, but you see it cited and the results repeated even up as late as year 2000. Then the recent results are the ones that he wrote. The classical results, surprise. And they only make context in the context of what the classical results, because they just refer back to them and say, well, you know what those are, so now we're going to do this. And they also should be noted they are done more in the exploration of the multiverse rather than trying to overturn fine-tuning. But you do one, you do the other. So the first one to look at from the classical results is dimension. We have Well, we are three spatial dimensions and one time dimension. So we are that white dot here. You go up a little bit more, you don't get stable atoms and orbits. We need orbits, and we certainly need atoms to live. You go down, you can't even make a digestive tract. And so it'd be very hard to make life, and certainly not make complex life, if you went down in dimensions. And if you go either up or down in time dimensions, you get some unpredictabilities. For the moment, let's not worry about what it means to have multiple time dimensions. Tegmark, in this case, was as much a mathematician as he is a physicist. And you can do the math just fine with multiple time dimensions. This, though, is a mathematical result, and it's fairly reliable. The next one you get is the neutron-proton mass ratio. The actual is the purple line at the top. And what it is a neutron can decay in free space into a proton, electron, and a neutrino. And if it's above a certain level, it can do that. That is said to give you enough protons in the early universe to make free hydrogen. And you need free hydrogen to make water, which is a key biophilic molecule and obviously element. You go down in neutron mass, neutrons become stable. You'll have now minimal hydrogen, mostly helium in the early universe, no hydrogen, no water, no life. And if you go down a little further, protons can go to neutrons. Well, no protons, no atoms. Well, we need atoms to live. So it's constrained on one side, but it is one of the standard constraints talked about. Now, for the following slides, I am going to use, well, this transformation is used by Tegmark and others. Basically, the force constants go from zero to infinity. That's a little hard to plot. So this is telling you how they actually shoehorn it into a finite plot. And this, then, is the premier fine-tuning plot that you'll see both in Barrow and Tipler, and I lifted it from Tegmark because it was easier to lift, because also, by the way, it was in color. And basically, we are that black dot here, a little bit above a assert diproton disaster. This line is where deuterons become, below which deuterons become unstable. And what it comes down to is diproton disaster is that you have protons that combine to make two protons. It's going to give you elemental helium when you start to do the chemistry. And they assert, well, if it all goes to that, you have no hydrogen, no life. Below this, you need stable deuterium in the middle of the stars to give the correct burning cycle from hydrogen to deuterium to helium to make stars so they would continue. So below this, no stars, and that's a fairly tight constraint. And then the two vertical lines are from the grand unified theory, and it's really a consensus of what could be, but it's not one of those things where it says that if you go this way too much, something bad happens. You go something that way, something bad for life happens. We'll come back to that point in a moment. But that is then the premier diagram. It's sort of like a phase diagram, and it's certainly an excellent way to express it. Now, you also have the weak nuclear force, and here they're saying a few percent less hydrogen goes to helium again, surprise. And a few percent more neutrinos suppress supernovas. So while, yeah, you make biophilic elements above hydrogen, they don't go anywhere, and if they don't go anywhere, they don't go here, and you don't get life. They say a few percent, manually, say Barrow and Tipler do not give you, a 5% number or a 4% number. They're also rather sticky, loose on giving me the original journal article number. The new results, people accept this as taught, so I need to at least bring it up because they're going to talk about it. I talked about it intensely. Then there's the electron-proton ratio versus electromagnetic forces. And what you get here is, we're here, and oh, by the way, red box is 10x, 1/10 x, and so on, and green box is 2x, half x, just to give you an idea of the scale of the boundaries. And above that line, they claim that there is no ordered structures. Basically, this would be the localization of the electron versus the proton in a molecular structure. And it's also should be noted that this is a fuzzy line. We know that, you know, it's clear that one, they're not going to get ordered structures. Obviously, we do pretty good here. But somewhere in here, not exactly sure exactly where, you go from one to the other. And then if you go down a little further, you don't get stars. This range here is a factor of 20 up to here and a factor of 2,000 down here. So you have a range of 4 times 10 to the 4 in there. This is a nonlinear scale. And then sort of to recap what I've gone through just for a moment, okay, the spatial and time dimension is unique. The proton mass ratios are really constrained on one side only. Electron proton, well, again, it's a fairly wide range. And again, the electromagnetic by the grand unified, and the strong and weak are the things that give you the really tight constraints. However, since year 2008, we're starting to see articles that talk about alternate physical constants to make the biophilic elements. And the first of these is Bradford. And basically, what he's saying is that while, yeah, you're going to make diprotons, they would be stable. They're not going to be made at a very high rate compared to deuterons. So, yeah. So you're going to end up with a lot of deuterium in the early universe. Deuterium is going to be chemically hydrogen. And you would also get stars with a slightly different burning cycle. So you still get stars. And he goes up to 1.4 times the observed strong force, which is better than the few percent you saw earlier with the diproton disaster. He also has a secondary, more speculative discussion claiming that it looks like you can go up to four times the observed strong force. He was very cagey about it. He said this only shifts the burden of proof back to the people who assert diproton disaster. He was the first. Now, the second guy was more assertive in the matter. And he goes up to 1.5 times the observed strong force. You get a more tightly bound deuteron, you get a bound diproton, but he's showing through his work that the diproton gets photodissociated in the early universe, so it doesn't hang around to cause trouble. Then for the weak force, Groves, Howes, and Adams. This is from 2018. Really published a pair of papers. First one I had without the weak force was the emphasis. That's a rather radical change in the parameter choice. You get a different path to nucleosynthesis. You get deuterium again and deuterium burning stars. And you get dispersal of elements by other things in the supernova. And then they come back around and talk about changing the, giving much stronger weak force. Now you get stable tritium. It's still chemically hydrogen, and you have stars again. And they explore this over a range of 10 to the 13th. There's a program that does a lot of the math for them. And they go from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the minus 9 to the observed value. That's a fantastic range when you consider what was seen before. And then there's finally the last article I'm going to show is the electromagnetic versus gravity. Basically, the solid line, well, Adams has as combines the strong and weak forces as the nuclear burning constant. And then he changes that by a factor of 100, which again is a large number. And he says that anything below that line, one can get stars. And the other issue here is that Adams totally ignores the grand unified theory work. Basically, my conclusion is between this, 2008 and, the Tegmark article in 1998, that they figured out, well, that really wasn't a good anthropic constraint. And that it's ignored is the big issue. And the other point of this one is that, over gravity, you have several orders of magnitude, and over electromagnetic, just a couple, a few. But nonetheless, that's not a tight plot. So to summarize this a little bit, unchallenged at this point, dimensionality, which remains strong, the two ratios, which are weak for various reasons, lower bound only and the 10 to the fourth makes it also weak. And I'm going to just say tightness is ignored because of the points that they just really not talked about. You still have some constraints, but they're considerably weaker. And I'm calling it weak because there's some question about exactly what's going on. It may yet be strong if somebody goes back and does the work on it. And then outrightly challenged would be the range of weak and strong and weak forces leading to biophilic elements. And I stress this is peer-reviewed journals. This is Physical Review D, among others. Nobody's complained about them yet, but this is also the most popular of the fine-tuning ideas. You get looser limits, but not arbitrarily loose limits. And so I'm saying this is for fine-tuning, don't touch it. It's likely to get worse. So what does this leave us for apologetics? Now, using intuitive criteria for apologetics, which is, I won't come back to that. Reliability is the dimensionality, of course. The ratios are, I wouldn't use them either because they're weak. Wouldn't use the electromagnetic business because it needs to be examined. It might yet become a good one if somebody can give me some good results on it. And in the year 2019, we should avoid the strong and weak force constraints. In the year 2007, this was a good result. Not anymore. So, unfortunately, strong and weak forces leading to biophilic elements is the standard one that most people use and want to have as the apologetic. The space-time dimensionality leaves a lot of people cold, but it's the only one really that I would trust at the moment.
So we've got time for questions.
As far as I know, I'm not a physicist, but there are some other constants that you did mention. Resonance for carbon, cosmological constant, there's a few others. So what can you tell us about the others that you didn't mention?
The resonance of carbon goes away when you start changing the strong force. If you increase it a little bit, beryllium 8 becomes stable. And now you can make carbon by adding helium to helium to helium. So that particular one goes away. The cosmological constant, giving the standard universe, is probably there. This is the one where they say everything is good to, needs to be the same within 10 to the 60th.
Something huge.
Yeah. And this is one that I'd really rather have a cosmologist rather than a solid state physicist talk about. But when things are that tight, you kind of get, I would get a little nervous to saying, this looks like that there's something else constraining it to that tight of a number. And maybe we should wait until a little bit more research has been done on that one. But that is, if you will, you know, if you're not cautious, yeah, you can use that 10 to the 60th. If you are cautious, well, you would be like me and say, no. But that's a matter of judgment.
Yeah, I'm wondering if these researchers have taken into account the material problem for life. A life is very intolerant to heavy hydrogen.
Well, they're taking the idea that if your primary hydrogen is deuterium, then life will be adaptable to deuterium.
But they've not shown how you could get like animal life that can handle heavy water.
Yeah, and if you have all deuterium now, single proton hydrogen would probably then be toxic. Deuterium in large amounts is toxic. Basically, it doesn't go in and out of a molecule nearly as well as single.
In biochemistry, there's something called the kinetic isotope effect. And so what you have is, if you have chemically, deuterium, of course, is the same at one level, but the kinetics are different.
That's right.
Because it's twice the mass.
Yeah.
Or a regular hydrogen. So, like what I'm thinking, so that's one issue I have. That enzymes don't treat chemically, yes, for the same, but in biochemistry, the kinetics are critical, especially in terms of enzyme reactions. And so, doubling the mass of all the hydrogen in your body is not a non-trivial thing to think through, I think. And I guess another question I have, maybe related to that one, is that, so you've shown that if we allow some wobble in these constants,
yeah,
we can do things like create tritium, we can create deuterium or things like that. But overall, if we allow this kind of plasticity, what kind of ratios of elements in general are we going to get compared to the universe that we have that seems to have a lot of the right kind of stuff? So it's one thing to say that you can allow the synthesis of other elements that life could use,
mm-hmm,
but do you have enough of those? Do you have nearly enough of those?
Yeah, well, really did not address that in this, to be sure. I was looking at, do you have the elements in the first place? And there's going to be a little bit more to it, and I probably bring up this one as an example of talking about the relative values and that you can now change other things. Here what they do is, this is out of how grows in atoms, and basically on the vertical line is neutron lifetime, which is a stand-in for the strength of this weak force, and on the horizontal line is the initial conditions. And what you see is, if you look at the, obviously we're here, but you can get that same hydrogen to helium ratio, which is what this is of, with a whole different set of neutron lifetimes, if you start changing your initial conditions. So there are other things to work with to get the things that we might want to get or might need to have, probably would be a better term. Obviously, I've worked, I've shown you seven parameters if you include the baryon ratio. That's starting to give you a big phase space to work with.
I have a two-part question. Do you find it useful to pursue fine-tuning as an apologetic method, and particularly the atheists I've read just blow it all away, saying there's 10 to the 500 possible universes, so it's not surprising if a couple here or there are tuned for life?
You know, this is where maybe I'm going to go back to this question. Just how improbable does it have to be before you invoke God? And I don't see people talking about this from a theological standpoint. It always tends to be this, well, it's a few percent. Well, unfortunately, you can also say, well, a few percent, if you have an interval of 10%, you still have an infinity of numbers between those numbers, so a large number of universes could also have life, for example. Just how many of them? This is one that I would like to have somebody tell me how to work with. And I really, my opinion on the matter, I think, would address your thing, that I would like to see a discussion of this before I would want to step in and use fine-tuning as a definitive apologetic. Maybe I'm scared, I don't know.
Let's thank our speaker.